to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
Have you ever wondered why the bankers from the largest private banks are becoming wealthier and the rest of us are not? Have you ever wondered why we are spending $160 million a day on the interest of the national debt? That's $60 billion a year. Have you ever wondered who receives the $60 billion? What I have discovered is the banks and the government have colluded to financially enslave the people of Canada.
And on that cheery note, we land squarely on our topic for today: how financial entrapment by central banks continues our forced servitude to private interests. Hello, and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, chair of the Public Banking Institute. Well over 10 million people have now heard Victoria Grant's simple proposition since she delivered it to our public banking conference in Philadelphia back in 2013. The simplicity of her approach and the weight of her words coming through her powerful small voice was captivating. And we're still addressing her questions. Why do we pay so much interest to private bankers when we really don't need to? But we now have some news out of Canada that seems to have created a serious setback to the Comer legal case, that is the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, which has been attempting to try to force the return of the Bank of Canada to its rightful practice of standing as a public bank, being able to issue the government interest-free money for its infrastructure and other public purposes. The Bank of Canada did this quite successfully for 40 years. Back in the 30s, as you'll find out later on, it was with the public banks' interest-free lending into their economy that Canada built the St. Lawrence Seaway, the Trans-Canada Highway, financed their participation in the war, built their health care system and their education system, a really sterling record of what a public bank can do. Victoria Grant's brief speech, which we'll be listening to once again a bit later on in the program, speaks to the heart of the Comer legal challenge, which apparently has yet another day in court to look forward to, by the way. Matt Standard will tell us about that. But the importance of this effort for the rest of us non-Canadians lies in the prospect of being able to actually recover sovereign control of our money supply from the globally entrenched private banks that have taken hold of virtually everything on the planet. If the Federal Reserve were publicly owned, for example, we wouldn't be struggling with trying to pay back a national debt, or wonder where we're going to be getting the money to fix our infrastructure, or a host of other needs and desires that we are entitled to. It's this basic first reality of private control of our money supply that holds the key to breaking free of the international oligarchs that have us all locked into debt slavery. Ellen's guest today, Josh Ryan Collins, got his PhD on the subject of Canada's public central bank, so his comments are particularly timely and instructive. Josh will give you the primary lesson on why central bank financing through private debt is the scandal of scandals. Later on in this show, Matt Standard, himself a holder of a law degree, will review the Comer process in light of the broader legal struggle to capture control of the public's money. That Canadian battle portends a lot for all of us as we make our case against the global private banksters that own our central bank, the non-Federal Reserve. Ellen has been traveling of late, perhaps as you'd expect from the Johnny Appleseed of public banking, as Les Leopold called her, and has just returned from multiple speaking engagements with our friends on the other edge of the Atlantic, Iceland, the UK, Wales, and she even wound up in Switzerland. The occasion for her talks were events in those places created to address the prospect of creating publicly owned public interest banks in their countries.
Welcome back to America, Ellen. You've had a remarkable couple of weeks abroad, and we're all anxious to hear about what kind of information you gathered when you were in Iceland and the UK and Wales, etc. What about Iceland?
I was invited to speak in Iceland by the Dawn Party, which has been pushing for a public bank for a couple of years, but they hadn't really gotten a lot of traction on it. And they thought that maybe if they brought in an outsider, that would make it to the into the news. I mean, Iceland is about the size of North Dakota. I think it's half the size of North Dakota. It's 320,000 people. Mm-hmm. Originally in Iceland, the banks were nationalized right up till 2003. They were gradually privatized up till 2003, and then immediately within 5 years they had collapsed, triggered the collapse of the whole EU banking system. I mean, you know, they were the first domino to fall, and you would think that keeping them public would be the obvious solution, go back to nationalizing them, but somehow the government has gone back to being conservative, neoliberal. So even though they got a change in governments, they had this wonderful pots and pans revolution that we all heard about and got so excited about, and they lost ground. They passed a new constitution initiative by referendum, and the legislature refused to endorse it. So back where they were. There's a lot of cronyism that goes on and corruption, but that can all be fixed if they come up with a public bank with a mandate to serve the public that's totally transparent, where you can see what's going on. I mean, it's all in how you set up the deal, but the problem is the people just aren't in control. Their legislature is still controlled by big money, as they are everywhere. So speaking of which, then because I was going to Iceland, then I wound up being invited to Manchester, where we have a budding public banking group, and they were having a conference. So I spoke there. Because I was passing through London, I wound up getting invited to speak at the Royal Society of Arts. So I spoke at two places. In England, they don't really have a bunch of community banks. They've only got the big City of London banks. So they don't have anybody to sort of feed through a mini central bank like the Bank of North Dakota is. So they have to use a sort of different model. The conference in Manchester was excellent. It was amazing, the lineup of speakers they got in a very short time. So there was a lot of interest. And one of the speakers was Richard Warner, who has set up it really is a public bank, and they're already making loans, even though they don't have their official banking license yet, but they're working on it, and they'll get it. But he's calling it a community bank because I guess the word public bank has some negative connotations there, like it means socialist. But in fact, the funding is coming from the government, so it really is a public bank of the sort that we're talking about. So that may be the first of our public banks that comes online. We'll see, you know, new ones that comes online.
Right.
And then we also have a budding public banking group in Wales, and so since they heard I was in town, they invited me to, or not exactly in town, but anyway, in the area, so they invited me to speak in Wales as well. And that was really interesting. Wales is great. It's amazing that on the other side of the world, you have people that are reading the same things. They're totally excited about the same things. They're peering into the same things. So one interesting thing that's going on in England is right now in the news is something we don't hear about much here, but it's Brexit, which is the equivalent of Grexit. There's an initiative for Britain to leave the EU, which I just read the latest, and apparently the odds now are 3-1 before.
3-1 that they would.
3-1 against, before it was 6-4 against. So it's, the odds are slipping. It's probably not going to pass. But and then I was the arguments against doing it are all about that the pound would lose some value and productivity would fall off and so forth. But what they're not considering is the advantages of they could then have their own central bank. The Bank of England could then issue money directly to the government. The government could issue the Bradbury pound, which was the equivalent of what Lincoln did in the Civil War, where he just issued greenbacks. So England actually issued Bradbury pounds during World War I, a little known and historically buried fact. So they could do that again, issue money directly, stimulate the economy as we know they could. I mean, we know all the wonderful advantages of having total control, government control of your currency, and not having it be controlled by what's called an independent central bank, but meaning a bank that marches to the tune of the big banks rather than to the tune of the popular will.
Right.
And another big advantage, if they were to leave, is that they would escape the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, and TISA,
right.
which is probably even worse, the Trade and Services Agreement, which we know all the downsides of that. So those are deals that the EU is entering into, but the UK,
really?
If it were independent, could avoid that. The people would be in favor of all that, but the current government obviously is not. Jeremy Corbyn has definitely sparked a big popular movement. And in fact, Jeremy Corbyn himself is not in favor of Brexit. And the reason is it's supported by the far right, like sort of the equivalent of libertarians here in the U.S., people who want national sovereignty, and therefore the left. You have all these political issues. But in fact, it looks to me like it would be good for the UK overall to do it. But I suppose it's not going to happen. Still, the fact that they're even talking about all these monetary things, monetary reform is now in the news, something that you never heard about before.
Thank you very much, Ellen. Welcome back. Glad you're back safely. Hopefully we'll keep you around for a little bit. Take care.
Now, to begin our focus on the Canadian Central Bank power struggle, or at least the people's struggle with the power of the Bank of Canada, we're going to take a couple of minutes to revisit the wisdom of the innocents. The person we'll hear from next was 12 years old when she wrote and delivered this school project speech in her Canadian hometown of Kitchener, Ontario. It started getting attention after Victoria Grant won a speech competition and delivered this remarkable piece to about 600 Rotary Club members. Shortly after seeing this posted on the Internet, the Public Banking Institute invited Victoria to Philadelphia to present it to those gathered at our first conference back in 2012, at which point it went viral and since then has received well over 10 million views by people all over the world. What seems to move people is how accurate and simple it all is. Listen for yourself and see whether Victoria Grant, who is now 15, by the way, didn't hit this topic squarely on the head.
Have you ever wondered why Canada is in debt? Have you ever wondered why the government forces Canadians to pay so many taxes? Have you ever wondered why the bankers from the largest private banks are becoming wealthier and the rest of us are not? Have you ever wondered why the gross national debt is over $800 billion, or why we are spending $160 million a day on the interest of the national debt? That's $60 billion a year. Have you ever wondered who receives the $60 billion? What I have discovered is the banks and the government have colluded to financially enslave the people of Canada. I will share with you three important points of reference, which will hopefully spark enough interest and concern for you to continue the research on your own and to engage your government to stop this criminal act against the people of Canada. First, we will briefly examine the Bank of Canada. Second, we will see how our banking system works today. And lastly, I will offer a viable solution that we can petition our government to implement. A very little known figure in Canadian history is J.O. Grattan McGeer. He was a lawyer, member of parliament, and mayor of Vancouver. His contribution to Canada is probably the greatest in our history. He championed the creation of the National Bank of Canada, whose sole purpose is to create and manage Canada's money. It was formed on July 3, 1934, and owned by all Canadians. Until the 1970s, because of the Bank of Canada, Canada's national debt was held at a constant, manageable level until the government decided to implement what we now have as our modern-day banking system that is robbing the Canadian people. So how are they robbing us? Allow me to explain how our private banks and government work today. First, the Canadian government borrows money from the private banks. They then lend the debtors money to Canada with compounded interest. The government then continues to increase taxation of Canadians year after year in order to pay back the interest on the exponentially growing national debt. What results is inflation, less real money for Canadians to spend into our economy, and the real money being used to pad the pockets of the banks. Also, the government gave the banks the ability to loan out money that doesn't exist in the form of loans. When a bank gives you a mortgage, which literally means a death pledge, or a loan, they don't actually give you money. They click a key on a computer and generate the fake money out of thin air. They don't actually have it in their bank vaults. Presently, the banks only have $4 billion on reserve, but they have loaned out over $1.5 trillion. To quote Graham Towers, each and every time a bank makes a loan, a new bank credit is created. New deposits, brand new money. Broadly speaking, all new money comes out of a bank in the form of loans. As loans are debt, then under the present system, all money is debt. What I find interesting is even Jesus in Matthew 21 drove out the money changers in the temple because they were manipulating the currency to steal money from the people. The private banks are just like the money changers in Matthew 21. They are defrauding and robbing the people of Canada, thus their freedom, and they need to be stopped. How should the banking system work? In an infamous interview, Mr. McGeer asked Mr. Towers, "Can you tell me why a government with power to create money should give that power away to a private monopoly and then borrow that which Parliament can create itself back at interest to the point of national bankruptcy?" Mr. Towers replied, "If Parliament wants to change the form of operating the banking system, then certainly that is within the powers of Parliament." In other words, if the Canadian government needs money, they can borrow it directly from the Bank of Canada. The people would then pay fair taxes to repay the Bank of Canada. This tax money would in turn get injected back into our economic infrastructure and the debt would be wiped out. Canadians would again prosper with real money as the foundation of our economic structure and not debt money. And yes, we have the power and lawful right to do so. Regarding the debt money owed to the private banks, such as the Royal Bank, we would simply have the Bank of Canada print the money owing, hand it over to the private banks, and then clear the debt with the Bank of Canada. And yes, we have the power and lawful right to do so. In conclusion, it has become painfully obvious, even for me, a 12-year-old Canadian, that we are being defrauded and robbed by the banking system and a complicit government. What will we do to stop this crime? What will we do to ensure that the next generation will live free and clear of the debt-based economy that enslaves them to the banks? Margaret Mead said the following, and I hope that all of you remember this. Never doubt that a small group of people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. Thank you.
Having heard Victoria's speech, we're now ready to take a few minutes with Ellen and her guest to delve into some of the theory and policy of public finance that's being brought forward around the world. Ellen's guest is an expert on all of these central bank questions.
I'm speaking with Dr. Josh Ryan Collins, an economist and associate director at the New Economics Foundation, one of the UK's leading think tanks. Among other works, Josh is the lead author of a best-selling guide to the monetary system titled Where Does Money Come From?, which is used as a textbook in a number of universities. He also co-founded a local currency in London called the Brixton Pound. It's great to be talking to you, Josh.
Thanks, Ellen.
You recently published an excellent doctoral dissertation that basically shows that we can fund all sorts of infrastructure and social services just by issuing the money, and that this would not create price inflation. Your paper is titled, Is Monetary Financing Inflationary? A Case Study of the Canadian Economy, 1935 to 1975. So first off is what I want to talk about, and I want to talk about the Canadian lawsuit that just got dismissed. But first off, what do you mean by monetary financing?
Well, by monetary financing, I essentially mean that rather than governments borrowing money from the private sector, from financial markets, to fund increased expenditure, or funding that expenditure in the normal method through raising taxes from households and from businesses, the government funds its spending via either the government itself or the central bank creating new money. Governments have historically always created money, and the power to create money in some ways resides with the state. It's the state that determines the unit of account, dollars, sterling in the UK case, euros in the eurozone case, and it also does have the power to create money, and the central banks, as we've seen in the last since the crisis, have created huge amounts of money via quantitative easing. So monetary financing essentially refers to the central bank in modern times financing government spending via purchase of government debt, government bonds, treasury bills in the US case, enabling the government to expand its spending without having to draw on taxpayers or borrow at interest from financial markets.
So quantitative easing is basically monetary financing, right?
It's not actually monetary financing, because the money that the central bank creates doesn't finance government spending. It simply places increased central bank money and deposits in the hands of investors, pension funds, and the type of organizations that buy government bonds on the secondary market. Monetary financing refers to the central bank buying newly issued government debt directly from the government. Quantitative easing involves the central bank buying government debt or treasury bills after it's already been purchased by private investors and the financial market. So in a way, quantitative easing is sort of saying the market still knows best. We'll let the market buy the bonds, but we will buy a proportion of those bonds to try and increase the liquidity in the financial system, in banks and in financial institutions, in the hope that that will then lead private investors to, for example, buy corporate equity or assets, shares and stocks and shares in companies, and that will lead those companies to spend more money into the economy. But it's quite a convoluted process. All of those different steps have to happen before new money actually goes into the economy.
Well, I was thinking that through myself, and it seems to me that maybe arguably what the difference is that the government doesn't recognize this as additional money available. If it said, all right, we're going to sell some bonds on the open market, and we know that the Federal Reserve or the central bank is going to buy those bonds and that they're not going to sell them back, you know, they'll just hold on to them like they always do, and they're going to return the interest to us. So basically it's interest-free money. If they knew that they were going to get this extra money, they could say, so great, we can spend some more money so we can do some more infrastructure. But they
That's
don't.
Right.
They think of it as debt. And they have it, like in the U.S., we have a debt ceiling, and everybody's worried about austerity and balancing the budget. So they just don't recognize that they have a way of increasing the money supply that won't affect their actual.
Yes. Yes, that's right. And quantitative easing in both the US and the UK and the Eurozone is seen as still really talked about as a temporary measure. So the idea is the central bank buys the government bonds, but can at any time sell those government bonds back into the market and withdraw the newly created money when inflation starts to pick up and the economy starts to pick up. So you're right in the sense that the government is not really in a position to say, oh, all of this new money has been created via the sale of our bonds. We can now expand our spending because the policy is a sort of monetary policy rather than a fiscal policy that enables government to change its spending behavior.
Mm-hmm. Ben Bernanke said that the point was to lower the interest rates on medium and long-term debt. Or long-term loans, but that seems like a pretty thin goal for such a radical sort of policy. I mean, one wonders, I wonder if that's what they're really up to. What do you think?
Well, I think that is the sort of theoretical explanation for QE. In the monetary textbooks that you'll look at, the economics textbooks that you'll read if you study economics at university, you will see that the main goal of monetary policy is to adjust interest rates to try and either inflate or deflate the economy and target inflation. In reality, you can equally make an argument that quantitative easing had another function, or perhaps two functions. The first function was it, in one sense, bailed out the banking system because it meant there was a huge amount of free liquidity for the banks and very cheap liquidity for the banks because, as you may remember, in 2007, 2008, the big problem was the banks stopped borrowing from each other. They lost trust in each other. And this QE floods the banking sector with very cheap free money, essentially. And the other purpose of the policy, of course, is that it massively lowers the interest that government pays on the debt that it issues. So it does save the government's money. What it doesn't do is necessarily support economies and societies in an effective way because it doesn't enable governments to, for example, invest in much needed infrastructure, as may be the case in the US. You need bridges built and roads built and improved. As I said, it doesn't enable governments to increase their spending on socially useful activities such as those things.
The general perception is that it has created inflation because the stock market has gone up, real estate has gone up, food has gone up, but that's not a direct result. So how do you think those are linked?
So what quantitative easing does is it essentially involves, as I said, the central bank buying bonds, government bonds that are held by pension funds. And it means that pension funds and institutional investors have to buy other kinds of bonds to maintain the yields that they're receiving on their assets, the interest rates that they receive on their assets. So what you've seen is those investors buying other forms of assets, in particular shares and stocks in big large companies, for example, which of course has increased the price of those stocks and shares, which leads to a general increase in asset prices. In the UK, we've seen a big increase in house prices, partially because you've had investors and households buying into property, which is inflating it for the same sorts of reasons. And a stated goal of QE.
More as a function of the interest rate, though, because the interest rate has gone so low for big investors.
Yes, well,
they can't make any money any other way, so they're putting it into hard assets. I mean,
that's right. They can't, because interest rates are very low. Banks, for example, can't make the returns they would make from lending to businesses. So they're buying other kinds of assets, and the same with investors. Yes, that's true.
You've talked in your paper about the Canadian experience as a model. So we've talked about that some before, but can you go into that?
Yeah, so after the Great Depression, or during the Great Depression in Canada, there was quite a lot of public anger at the banking system because it was felt that the banks were not lending to particular parts of the economy, in particular sort of agrarian sector. So they weren't lending either enough or at interest rates that were very punitive. So there was a lot of anger. And in the election in 1935, I think it was, the Social Democratic government, a party that was challenging in the election, ran on a mandate of creating a central bank. In fact, both parties ran on a mandate of creating a central bank to better support the wider economy, a Canadian central bank, because previously Canada had been under the sterling zone influence, under control of the British central bank, effectively, and the British, it was a sterling economy. And the central bank was thus created in 1935, with a very broad public mandate. And one of the things it had written into its constitution was that it was permitted to buy a proportion of government debt and also municipality debt. So if the municipalities issued loans, this equivalent of the states in the United States, the central bank could buy a proportion of those loans to again, fund public, much-needed public infrastructure. And that went on, actually, for quite a long period, 40 years, right up to the mid-70s. And my study found that around a quarter of public debt was monetized by the central bank via the direct creation of new money. And, of course, that period was one of the most successful, if not the most successful, in Canadian history, economic history. And it wasn't, interestingly, a period of high inflation, as most of the economics textbooks would have you believe.
And so you established that with an econometric model, which which people won't understand. But so can you just say, like, in a summary what that means?
Yeah, so essentially it's just a statistical analysis of the relationship between the monetary financing, the printing of new money by the central bank, and inflation, and a number of other factors. And what I found was that the inflation that the Canadian economy did experience over that period, and it never got very high except for a brief period in the late 50s, which I think was related to the war in Korea, but the inflation that it did experience could not be attributed to the monetary financing activity. It was a closer relationship with inflation in the United States, actually, and other sort of standard explanations. So because it was a long period that I studied, I looked at quarterly data from 1940 or 1950 up to 2015. It's quite a comprehensive study that shows that essentially this monetary financing activity was not inflationary. And there's very few other studies that look at a period of that length of time to investigate this dynamic.
And then something happened in 1974, 1975, and the policy changed. Do you want to go into that?
Yeah. Well, this is quite an interesting sort of puzzle, really. It seems that at a certain point in the early 70s, the Canadian Central Bank chose to stop this monetary financing policy. The Canadian government was controlled during that period by a monetarist regime. As monetarism emerged in a number of countries, including the US in the early 70s, and the argument of the monetarist was essentially that inflation is always a monetary phenomenon, so it's caused by too much money being created by the central bank or the government, and the way to control it is by essentially creating less of it or withdrawing money from the economy by buying back bonds, government bonds. So the opposite of quantitative easing, if you like. And the government of the day in Canada chose to do this, and they chose to essentially stop this monetary financing program. Another quite interesting development was that Canada at the time joined the Bank of International Settlements, a sort of international club of central banks, which has quite a lot of control over the regulation of monetary policy today. That may also have had something to do with it. The Bank of International Settlements is not very predisposed towards this kind of monetary financing activity, as with many other standard economic bodies like the IMF and the World Bank. It considers that activity to be inflationary and dangerous for the economy. And it may have been that one of the preconditions for the Canadian Central Bank joining the Bank of International Settlements is that it stopped this monetary financing activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've written about that too. I have a more suspicious slant on it, but it looks to me like the BIS, the Bank for International Settlements, was set up specifically to keep control of the money system with the banks and not allow governments to issue their own money, as Australia was doing and New Zealand was doing for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, it does appear that there is a strong argument to be said that the Bank of International Settlements is really a banker's bank rather than a government-run institution. The members of the BIS are central bankers, and there's also some private banking interests represented there. Treasury ministers are not part of the club. Democratically elected representatives are not part of a club. So your suspicions have some founding there. However, there's very little written evidence that in the Canadian case, they dropped this policy because of their membership of the BIS. However, I'd welcome your listeners to go out there and try and find out some evidence to show the case one way or the other.
And then we have this Comer suit that the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform in Canada,
yes,
brought a lawsuit to try to get the government to return to its allegedly constitutional mandate to borrow directly from its own,
yes,
bank interest free. And it just now got dismissed, unfortunately, and the costs were all, or the plaintiffs have to pay the defendant's costs, which I'm sure is a tidy sum. So that's too bad. What do you make of that, and why was it dismissed?
Well, I haven't looked into it in depth, but Comer's lawsuit really was getting right to the heart of the issue that we're talking about. It was arguing that the Bank of Canada had essentially not been following its constitutional obligations in terms of outlawing this prohibiting this monetary financing activity, which, as I said right at the beginning of our discussion, was a fundamental part of the reason it was brought into being. So I had a lot of sympathy with the Comer lawsuit. And clearly in this case, the judge has just simply decided that it was not an appropriate case. I don't know the reasons why, but obviously the suspicion is that this was too big a threat to established elite interests in the Canadian state. And I wouldn't want to, you know, speculate on who may have pressured whom, but it's a very sad day, obviously.
Yeah, he said something like that this group, this think tank, thinks they can come in and just tell the government what to do. So it looks like it's a standing issue, and the government itself will have to recognize what it could do with its, you know, what powers it does have, and actually proceed with them as it did before. So I would think the good of it, I mean, I'm sure they must be gravely disappointed, but what they have done is at least gotten some publicity on the issue, and maybe raised some awareness. It seems to me that if enough people get it, that we do have the power to create all the money we need for productive things, for the infrastructure we need, you know, not for speculation, which obviously will make inflation and will unbalance the economy. But if it's actually put into things that are productive, that increase GDP, I think there are a number of studies showing that, or I think the IMF, I think Christine Lagarde actually said that you increase GDP by something like 1.5 times the money you put into it from infrastructure.
Yeah, the economic multiplier. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I think the lawsuit has highlighted the potential really for central banks and ministries of finance to do more to support the global economy. And Christine Lagarde's called for governments to just borrow more, essentially, because interest rates are so low. And that is certainly an option. But another option is simply that central banks broaden their mandate. So most central banks in the world now are focused on inflation, and only on inflation, rather than in the U.S. you have a broader mandate. There is a focus on employment, but
in theory, do they do it? Not really.
Yeah, it seems in theory they're more focused on inflation, and I think clearly the current policy of very low interest rates isn't achieving the outcome of higher employment and growth. It isn't getting money into the right parts of the economy. As you said, it's leading to increases in asset prices, in house prices, stocks and shares, which is extremely regressive. It means that people who are already rich get richer, and people who are poor effectively get poorer because they can't access housing and other forms of assets. And so central banks need to really seriously consider other policy tools, such as monetizing the debt or a proportion of the debt, investing in infrastructure and other socially useful activities. And in the US, I think it's fairly straightforward that this could happen. In the Eurozone, we're slightly constrained by constitutional laws. It's interesting we're having this debate in the United Kingdom about leaving the Euro leaving the European Union at the moment. And one of the things that's never mentioned in the debates, which are all about immigration and you know, regulation of toasters, is that our membership of the EU bans us from monetizing debt in the way the Canadian government did. And that's one interesting area that I'm hoping that we'll try and get more into the debate as it goes on.
Yeah, that's interesting. So what do you think? Are you actually going to leave the EU, or how's the...
I wouldn't like to give you a straight answer to that one, Ellen.
Okay.
But it's very close. It's very close at the moment.
Were to leave the EU, then the Bank of England could just issue money directly? I mean, it probably wouldn't, but...
Yes. Essentially, when we joined the EU in 1990, I think, 3 or 4, we had to sign a treaty called the Treaty of Maastricht. It's a place in Holland, actually, in the Netherlands. And one of the key articles of the constitution of the Maastricht Treaty is that no central bank is permitted to monetize government spending or buy government bonds on the primary market, i.e. directly from governments. Only the European Central Bank is permitted to engage in this type of activity, and even they are not really allowed to, although they have effectively with quantitative easing. So if we left the EU, we would no longer have that constraint applied to the British government. We would be free to buy government debt as we thought it was appropriate, which I think would be a good thing. There's many other reasons not to leave, but that's one of the reasons to leave, I think.
I was just in Wales. I'd spoken London with you, and I stayed with you, which is great. Thank you very much.
No problem.
So I spoke at the Royal Society of Arts and in Iceland and in Manchester and in Wales on the possibility of establishing local public banks.
Yes.
And in the Maastricht Treaty, I know Article 123 says that no government can borrow directly from the central bank, but that a publicly owned bank can borrow. I mean, they're not foreclosed. So that is a way of creating money, just like the Bank of North Dakota does. The Bank of North Dakota is a publicly owned bank that doesn't have the power to issue money directly, but like all banks, it creates money when it makes loans, and it's got a huge deposit base, so it can make a lot of loans. So, and it can, because it's a government institution, it can direct those where the economy specifically needs them. But I know in Wales that they were bemoaning the fact that under the EU rules they weren't able to set up a Bank of Wales that would be independent and that would issue money. But if you left the EU, that would be possible.
Yeah, I think it might be possible to set up a public bank in the UK, even if we stayed in the EU. But it would be easier if we left, because there's also these competition laws.
And it would be difficult to get the Bank of England to switch policies, I would think, because
the
tradition. But you could set up a Bank of Wales, a Central Bank of Wales, which has a different, it's small, it has its own. I'd love to see any little experiment where any little country like Iceland the people are all totally ready to do something different. The problem is the government really is still in the control of conservative big money elements.
Yeah,
could happen in one of these.
And I think it will. I think it will eventually. I mean, I do think that the current financial system is essentially pre-programmed to crash again, where you've got all of this money flowing into financial assets rather than into the real economy. That will lead to, I mean, in the UK, for example, we have very high house prices relative to people's income. At a certain point, house prices will fall, and that will lead to a general financial crisis and a recession. And I think at that point, the British people won't be happy just to bail out the banks again. We did quite a lot of that last time, and I think that's when you have the potential to create public banks that are constitutionally obliged to lend in socially useful ways into the real economy, not just to support speculative activity. And the New Economics Foundation is working with a number of communities around the UK which are already looking at how you might start these sorts of banks. But it is challenging. You need a lot of money to start a bank. and you need quite a lot of energy to get through the regulatory hurdles that the Bank of England and regulatory authorities put up, essentially.
Yeah, Richard Warner has a bank started, as you know.
That's right.
Moving right along, it might be one of our first new examples. That's
yeah.
Great. Well, it's been great talking to you.
Yeah, great to talk to you, Ellen.
Anything more you'd like to add? Do you have websites or?
Yes, yeah, so you can find out more about the work of the New Economics Foundation at our website, which is www.neweconomics.org, and all our reports are free to download. Follow me on Twitter at @JRyanCollins.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thanks, Josh. I've been speaking with Dr. Josh Ryan Collins, an economist and associate director at the New Economics Foundation.
Now that we've gotten the lowdown on how things are wired in central bank land, let's revisit the legal landscape and see how this Bank of Canada legal matter is working out. We all had a bit of a scare last week, and actually that's what delayed this broadcast, because it appeared that the Comer case had been thrown out once and for all. But that's not the case by any means, as they're now heading to the Canadian Supreme Court.
I'm Matt Stannard with the Public Banking Report. The best causes are those where the odds are tough and the stakes are high. That makes the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform's case against the Bank of Canada one of the best causes of all. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, liberals in many Western democracies became neoliberals, drinking the Kool-Aid of private interests who whispered in their ears that inflation, rather than the lack of financial security, was the greatest social evil, and that the central banks could control this inflation through massive increases in interest rates. Canada was even a little ahead of the curve. The federal government, in 1974, began to borrow from private foreign banks to finance its public pensions, its transportation system, its healthcare system, its airports, seaports, and more. Why was this shift unusual? Because up until 1974, the federal government borrowed, sometimes interest-free, from its own bank, the Bank of Canada. That bank was originally chartered as what we would call a public bank. It didn't just lend out government money, but functioned like a bank functions, using fractional reserve lending to create lending credit at low or no interest to finance the Canadian social infrastructure in ways that were, first and foremost, governed by the needs of Canada itself, rather than the demands of private finance. When, in 1974, the Bank of Canada suddenly stopped doing that and instead borrowed at high interest, Canada started a slow but steep descent. Canada's transition to monetarism and capitalist globalization, typified by the Free Trade Agreement in the 1980s and NAFTA in the 1990s, has not been good for its working people. When the Bank of Canada could finance public goods by itself, this meant that the public coffers were free from ransacking by multinational private finance. When Canada put its own people above regional and global trade, this meant that wages were high and Canadian production was robust. But that all began to change when neoliberalism descended upon the country. Factories closed, wages decreased. The government commenced massive cuts in social spending. Perhaps the most important legacy of the Canada-US free trade deal, writes Jim Stanford, was the abandonment by the Canadian business class of any distinct national strategy for accumulation and development. Whereas previously leading Canadian firms and executives in many sectors were amenable to nationally oriented strategies, after the FTA, they began to identify almost exclusively with a continentalist and furthermore a globalist vision. Trade deficits, downward wage spirals, and the gradual weakening of the public sphere and social welfare followed. Canada was no longer a healthy social democracy. It became a kind of neoliberal Frankenstein's monster. So in 2011, the Committee for Monetary and Economic Reform sued the Canadian government. The plaintiffs alleged that the Bank of Canada is the only central bank among the G8 countries that is a public bank, created by statute and accountable to the legislative and executive branches of the government. The plaintiffs also argued that the bank's secretive dealings and accounting practices further undermined the ability of the government to meet its constitutional obligations to the Canadian people. The Canadian plaintiffs had a valuable procedural tool in this fight, public standing. It essentially allows citizens of Canada to bring lawsuits concerning social issues, to assert a genuine interest in a policy question, even if they are no more affected by that policy than any other citizen. That's something plaintiffs in the United States don't have, and it's gotten the Canadian plaintiffs through a few procedural appeals. But last month, a federal court judge reversed his own decision and struck down portions of the plaintiff's claim. It was the latest in a series of dodges and parries in the case, and of course, the plaintiffs appealed that action to the Federal Court of Appeal. If the plaintiffs don't prevail there, the case will go to the Supreme Court. What are the real stakes here? Well, some people see banking and money and the creation of value as private things, and others, the people at Comer's, those of us at the Public Banking Institute, see banking, money, credit, and valuation as public goods. I like to think of the difference as roads versus buildings. Businesses are like buildings. They're like houses. They're privately owned by and large, although public options for them ought to exist. And businesses transport those goods that they sell on roads. And I think that even if the businesses and the goods they ship are private, the roads should stay public. So in my mind, banking and money are the roads, not the buildings or goods. Everyone benefits from roads. The roads should be accessible to all, should grow and be shaped and repaired, and when necessary, expanded according to everyone's needs, not just the preferences of those who can afford to earn entire stretches of road. Similarly, money should be a public utility, and banking should be a public utility. Public utilities, like roads, shouldn't price people out. Let me go even further. When the Bank of Canada turned to private foreign lenders, it contributed to the commodification of life itself. That gesture allowed people who own more money than other people to sell the money for even more money. The result was spiraling Canadian debt, declining public services, greater economic insecurity for many Canadians, and a kind of national humiliation, the humiliation of subordinating national needs to supranational private interests, like a family who tells their children that now they have to start charging them interest for the privilege of eating at the dinner table. And it doesn't end there. Our surrender of public interest to private profits has decimated the quality of life in this world, and, in the ultimate irony, has undermined the private sector, since there's no longer any infrastructure to facilitate business growth and development, adequately educate the workforce and keep them healthy. Although Canada has dodged that bullet better than the United States has, neoliberalism continues to take its toll there, and things aren't what they used to be. So here's my three cheers for Comer's in their persistence, for helping build a jurisprudence of the commons, for taking a stand for public banking, for refusing to accept the commodification of public life. Maybe the plaintiffs won't prevail. If that's the outcome, we've all still won. Future Canadian policymakers will have evidence that public banking better fulfills the constitutional obligations of the government and might begin to legislate changes in Parliament that move Canada away from monetarism and neoliberalism. We all will benefit from learning more about how the ruling financial classes derive and defend their power. The global movement for financial democracy will be stronger. But maybe the plaintiffs will prevail. That resounding victory will move the dial on global economic justice and improve the quality of life for millions. and the private Wall Street dominoes will start to fall. Either way, my money, our money, should be with those brave and determined Canadian activists who, as their persistent appeals and ever-forward actions demonstrate, won't take no for an answer, especially not from a central bank. I'm Matt Stannard.
So there you have it. The pressure for monetary reform is building globally, from Iceland and the UK to Greece and Canada and the USA. The efforts are starting to cross over each other as people work in their own backyards to try to stop the massive extraction of public money into the maw of private finance. Hopefully, though, you're very clear that we are not against banks here at the Public Banking Institute. In fact, ironically, you could certainly say we're very pro-bank, if those banks are committed to serve the public and local economies. But that, of course, is where the break occurs. The global banks don't share any mission of that sort, despite what you may hear about their development investments and other social projects. The Public Banking Institute in the U.S. has made it very clear that we stand with local community banks and credit unions in their work to help finance local lives and businesses, and that they too need to be protected from big bank pressures that are put upon them. And before we close today, I want to tell you about another citizen frontline that's emerging in the form of a project being launched by the Public Banking Institute called What Wall Street Costs America. This is a first-ever national undertaking to expose how much money is getting sucked out of America's communities in the form of payments for interest, money management fees, and scandalous financial products sold to American communities by Wall Street bankers. The sums are staggering. Hundreds of billions of dollars are sent out of local economies each year just for dealing with and borrowing from the global banks. Is it any wonder why America's economy is on the edge? We'll be telling you more about this exciting new project and campaign called What Wall Street Costs America Incoming Programs. But if you'd like to get a sneak peek and perhaps find out about ways that you can participate with it, visit whatwallstreetcostsamerica.org. You'll see that this campaign is meant for everyone who has a story to tell or facts to share. It's time for the general public to learn about what happens to their hard-earned dollars when they pay their taxes and why they're not getting the results from their investment in local government that they deserve. After all, it is our money. Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.